Which listener-submitted question should be covered next in WFAE's FAQ City podcast? Do you want to know the secret code to light up the 7th Street station? Or how Charlotte's neighborhoods got their names? Why are uptown high-rises shaped differently? Cast your vote and subscribe to the podcast at wfae.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the NFL fines Jerry Richardson $2.75 million following its investigation into charges of misconduct. Amazon is coming after all. Not the headquarters, but a distribution center, and the city council votes to sweeten the deal. The U.S. Supreme Court decides not to hear the case involving possible political gerrymandering in North Carolina, deciding instead to send it back to the lower court, and our attorney general joins others around the country in a lawsuit over the president's child separation policy. Our roundtable of reporters is set to detail those and other stories this morning. And those reporters include Alex Olgan from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Kirsten Garris is here. She's government reporter for Spectrum News. Hello.
Good morning.
Glenn Berkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
And Eric Spanberg, who will host this show on Monday, just waiting for me to die. Senior staff.
Wow. I can always say good morning and good health to you, Mike.
Thank you very much. Senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal. And we're all on the radio, but if that's not enough for you, you can watch Eric on Facebook Live this morning. Yesterday afternoon, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced the league's findings in its investigation into former Panther owner Jerry Richardson and fined him $2.75 million. What did they conclude?
Well, they concluded that he did do the things he was accused of. The word that they used was substantiated, and they could find nothing that disproved what was alleged in the Sports Illustrated article. They also made a vague reference to other incidents without providing details of what those were. So I think when you boil it down, it is, you know, the final. The final step in a 6-month dissolution of Jerry Richardson's reputation in the Carolinas and in the NFL.
Well, he didn't fight it. I mean, as soon as these allegations were made, he said, well, the heck with it, I'm going to put the team up for sale. He didn't deny it ever, did he?
He never addressed it. He didn't deny it. He didn't admit to it. He didn't apologize. He didn't acknowledge it in any way. And He still hasn't, although I guess you would say if the fine is paid, which we assume it will be or has been, then that is an acknowledgement.
This struck me as a let's make it go away and move on move. It really did. From what I read, I just didn't see anything that led me to believe that this was really a vigorous investigation that, Eric said, it was very slim on details.
Really?
At least the published review on the NFL.com website provided no details into any of the allegations. So they said basically we couldn't find facts that they didn't happen, but we don't know which ones did happen.
Right. There was some wording in there. I'm going to butcher it a little bit, but it was to the effect of that they weren't going into all the details of allegation by allegation, but at the same time saying that there's absolutely nothing to disprove what has been alleged. So in a way, Sports Illustrated is the Sports Illustrated is the lead investigator in this case.
Mary Jo White is the person who conducted this investigation for the NFL, a former U.S. attorney and SEC chairman. I don't know how that figures into this, but she, as you said, found that allegations of sexual and racial misconduct, both those previously reported and some that were not, had been substantiated, that no other employees are allegedly engaged in any misconduct, and that the team had never reported to the league the financial settlements to former employees. How many settlements were made by the Panthers to these employees?
We know of the four that were reported by Sports Illustrated in December. We don't know if there are more, although, you know, the reference to, I guess, similar incidents would lead you to think that there very possibly could have.
So why would the NFL, this is not a good thing for them, this is the optics ones. Optics don't seem to matter to anybody about anything anymore, but why when you have an owner who does not protest, he just says, I'm selling the team, put the team up for sale, you conduct your independent investigation, quote unquote independent, and you don't give any more details than Sports Illustrated gives, why?
Well,
why wouldn't you go into the details?
Let's remember. Let's just start with a couple of points. First is remember that the
why bother is my question.
Well, because they think that this deflects the bad public relations that they're going through. But remember, the NFL league office and the commissioner work at the behest of the 32 owners. Not only that, Jerry Richardson in 2006 was the co-chair of the committee that hired Roger Goodell, who's the current NFL commissioner. So this was never going to be rough and tumble justice.
Okay. When these allegations came to light, as we've said, he immediately put the team up for sale. That has happened. David Tepper is the new owner. I think the deal will actually close in July or August, but he's paying a record price, $2.275 billion. They've now fined Jerry Richardson $2.75 million. Is this just a slap on the wrist? This is like the change left over on the table after the deal is signed, right?
A slap on the wrist is how the New York Times columnist described it. I mean, I don't have the exact math, but it's a less than 1%.
Yeah,
I tried to do the math. I had never dealt with numbers that high.
Yeah, exactly. Our calculators didn't work to do that.
But how many reporters I think it was like 0.1%.
Well, I'll borrow from Charlotte Squawks. If you're trying to figure out what $2.275 billion, and it's about 11 sandwiches from Dean and DeLuca.
There we go.
The late Dean and DeLuca.
Exactly. So, but it is worth noting that, I mean, I guess the majority of the NFL's press release about this really focused on what they're doing with the money. I think, again, they're trying to make this the best PR angle possible. So they're saying, you know what, we have fined Jerry Richardson, and with that money, we're going to donate it to organizations dedicated to, quote, addressing race and gender-based issues in and outside of the workplace.
Well,
so actually, there you go.
And I actually think that was a good move on
and that
part.
Is, yeah.
It was very smart to, you know, I think the NFL has an image problem already, mm-hmm. especially with African-Americans, with some women, and frankly, conservatives for that matter. So I thought that was a really smart thing for them to do.
So WFAE spoke with Tonya Lovely. She's the CEO of Women of Color Network, which is based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It's one of the organizations that's going to receive some of this money, Alex. Talk about that.
Yeah, she didn't know when my colleague talked to her yesterday how much they were going to get, but she agreed with Glenn and said that it was a good way to impose fines. She thought it would impose some kind of accountability because what she said was that it would go directly to the people or groups of people that Mr. Richardson, quote-unquote, harmed by his alleged misconduct.
By the way, this comes in the same week that the NFL is disciplining Jameis Winston, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers quarterback, for groping an Uber driver. So, yeah, not a good public relations week for the NFL.
So, Scott Fowler, sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer, has a front sports section column today that says the Jerry Richardson statue, the 13-foot-tall Jerry Richardson statue out in front of the stadium, must come down. Should it?
Well, just aesthetically pleasing there, aesthetically speaking, some would say, you know, it's kind of a goofy statue to begin with. But that's all up to David Tepper. I mean, it's his stadium. It's not a publicly owned stadium. And I think you're going to get opinions all over the place because there are still plenty of people out there who say, look, this man brought the NFL to Charlotte and the Carolinas, and that really changed a lot of things for the better. So there are people out there who I think would want to keep it. I think there are plenty of people who would take the other view.
Is this the same argument back and forth on both sides that could be used with the Confederate monuments? I mean, history is history. He did a bad thing. Some would say that the Confederacy did a bad thing. Is it the same argument?
I think it's where you honor these different figures. So, I mean, it might be, you know, do you put a statue or a plaque somewhere else of Jerry Richardson? I don't know. I mean, that's something that obviously David Tepper will have to decide. But I think it goes both ways. You know, people can make the argument for keeping it. Some can make it for against. But, I mean, if they want to do something inside, maybe that's a compromise. I mean, we'll see what happens when David Tepper takes the reins, I guess, next month probably, or okay. August.
I guess it's a cautionary tale about erecting statues to people who are still alive.
But
if you own the team and you own the stadium, you can...
You put your own statue.
Well, and I did. You know, we've had this when the charges or the allegations first surfaced. A lot of us were asking these questions about what happens to his name. And I checked with UNCC, for example, yesterday, because remember, Jerry Richardson has his name on the football stadium in the field. And they said that they're taking a look at it. And when you go to Wofford, which is his alma mater and also the training camp home of the Panthers, there's a statue. There are multiple buildings named for him and his wife. So I think there are going to be a lot of committee meetings over the next few weeks and months to figure out, okay, how do we handle this?
Well, moving on, the U.S. Supreme Court's been pretty busy in the last couple of weeks, and they decided this week, after deciding not to hear gerrymandering cases from two other states, the court decided not to take on North Carolina's partisan redistricting case, at least for now. They sent it back to the lower court. Did that surprise anybody, any legal experts out there?
Well, go ahead.
I'm no legal expert, but it did not surprise me. I thought all along that that case had some of the same problems and or challenges that, was it the Wisconsin
case? Maryland.
And Maryland yeah. That they also sent back. I know we said on the show last week, or at least some said, that they thought the court had a better opportunity to decide partisan gerrymandering with North Carolina. But I thought it had some of the same weaknesses.
Well, Wisconsin was dismissed because the court said that they did not prove, the plaintiffs did not prove that they had standing. In other words, they did not prove that they had been harmed by the Wisconsin law, and therefore they would not have standing, and to take it back to the lower courts and try to prove that. But in North Carolina's case, we had a legislator who voted for, and I think helped draw these districts, say the only reason we have X Republicans versus Y Democrats.
And three was because I couldn't get 11-2.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was fairly, intent was fairly clear.
I think intent was totally clear, but I think it had some of those same issues that you just mentioned in terms of challenging the entire map versus district by district. Mm-hmm. I think that's what the court was going at. That it wanted to look at district by district rather than issue rulings for an entire state.
And they clearly, I mean, when you see what happened in this session, they clearly remain very reluctant to take this on. I mean, you had three states where they essentially punted.
Yeah.
Why?
I suspect because it is, you know, because they haven't really delved into gerrymandering other than from the racial aspect, but from the partisan aspect, they've never really tackled that. And
isn't that their job?
Well, I think that they suspect that they, once you start to go into the political gerrymandering, then where does it ever end? I'm not defending the Supreme Court, but I think that's probably some of the thinking among the justices is, okay, once you start this, how do you stop the cavalcade of constant challenges?
So what are they asking the lower court to do? They've sent it back. They didn't dismiss the case. They didn't reject it. They just said send it back. So what are they asking the lower court to do? Does anybody know?
I thought they were asking the lower court to look at the issue of standing, the same issue in Maryland and Wisconsin, to see if the plaintiffs had standing.
Right.
Okay. Is the lower court likely to decide this case this time in a way that will satisfy both parties, or is this likely to go back?
It'll never satisfy both parties.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I can provide an instant no on that one.
So is it likely to go back to the Supreme Court at some time in the future? How does this work? I have no idea how it
possibly
works.
I mean, in the I thought I read that they would possibly take it up in October. There was a chance of that happening, but now we know that a justice is retiring, so who knows? Last time there were eight justices for a period of time, they didn't take a lot of cases.
And it would depend on what the lower court decides. If the lower court decides that the plaintiffs have no standing, then that would probably come closer to putting an end to it, at least for now.
Why didn't they decide that the first time around?
I would assume they did. Maybe the court just didn't.
I'm stumping the panel.
He is.
We're going to hear from Allison Riggs, the lead counsel for the plaintiff in this case, in just a moment. When we come back from the break, it's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Alex Olgan is here from the WFAE newsroom. Kirsten Garris, government reporter for Spectrum News. Charlotte Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. And Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, all here for the local news roundup.
Our host, Jeffrey Toobin, right?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. We were talking about that. You've thrown me for a loop.
I'm sorry.
We were talking about the Supreme Court's decision to send the North Carolina gerrymandering case back to the lower court. And Allison Riggs was the lead counsel for the League of Women Voters, one of the plaintiffs in that case. She hopes to get it back in front of the high court next term.
We think on remand, when we go back to the three-judge panel, that we'll be able to pretty quickly explain to the three-judge panel that we don't have any of the standing problems that the Wisconsin case did, and nothing about the Wisconsin opinion in any way undermines the decision that the three-judge panel reached on the merits.
So if she's successful in that effort, do we know that the court will take it back up, or could they just say refuse to hear it?
Yeah, they don't have to take anything back up. I mean, they being a Supreme Court justice is a lot of power.
So
as we talked about this week.
So is the likelihood of their ever hearing this case lessened in any way or changed in any way by the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy and his inevitable replacement, who will be probably further to the right than Mr. Kennedy is?
I mean, if I had to hazard a guess, I would think that it's less likely, assuming that, I would say less likely.
I'm not sure it's less likely to be heard. I think the outcome.
That's a better way to put it.
It's
in
doubt.
The outcome is much more in doubt. So thank you, Glenn.
Yes.
The court will inevitably...
Always ask Glenn, then come back to me.
The court will inevitably tilt more toward the right because Kennedy, though a conservative appointment, has been kind of a swing vote, taking some surprising stands on certain issues, including gay marriage. And because the Senate under Mitch McConnell has refused to hold hearings on President Obama's guy, Merrick Garland, and then went on to appoint Neil Gorsuch, it's already taken a slight more severe turn to the right. McConnell is not likely to use the excuse he used before about an impending election not being a good time.
Well, Mike, that's only for presidential years.
Exactly.
Not,
clarification
it's not
there
for non-presidential
years. And actually,
did you not read the clause?
But actually, Joe Biden holds some of the responsibility for this, too, because he did something several years ago that kind of set this precedent. This appointment, the one that's coming up by President Trump, is being promised to be voted on in the fall, before the election, which has the potential of changing the direction of the court for literally generations, perhaps 55 years, because the president wants to appoint somebody young who can, it's a lifetime appointment, who can stay there till he's 85 or 90. What's been the reaction among our lawmakers in this state? Has anybody said anything about this?
I haven't seen.
I haven't seen a whole lot
of reaction. You know, it's interesting. There's all this national reaction pouring in, and I just haven't heard a lot from the local delegation.
I mean, most of our local folks are Republican.
Sure,
you would think they would be giddy about this, but they haven't said anything.
Maybe it's too early because we haven't seen the list of nominees. So maybe when we see the list of nominees, then maybe we'll get some more reaction.
The nominees lists have all been vetted by something called the Heritage Foundation. They're a conservative to libertarian group that has made a list of recommendations, which I'm told the president used in the appointment of Neil Gorsuch and will probably use in the appointment of this next justice. Who are these people? Who are the Heritage Foundation? Does anybody know?
Not beyond what you just said.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
I mean, that's,
that.
Yeah.
That's,
right. I do know that the list, though, of potential nominees includes a couple of more judges who clerked for Kennedy, which, of course, Gorsuch did as well. So that's been interesting to kind of watch that process play out.
There's much renting of garments and gnashing of teeth over this on the left, but would it not be safe to say that even if President Trump was able to put a very conservative justice on the court, that the next time an opening occurs and there's a Democrat in the White House, even if somebody, I don't know what the rules are on this, even if somebody doesn't decide to retire, could the president not simply appoint an additional member of the Supreme Court? There is nothing in the Constitution that says how many members
there are. No, I think FDR tried that. I believe FDR tried
it. I know he did.
Yeah, I don't think you can, no.
Really?
You can't go beyond 9.
I think it has to be 9.
Yeah.
Is it in the Constitution? We'll check in the next break.
Exactly.
I have my pocket Constitution with me.
Our civics class will commence now.
If anybody knows, they can.
The first one to tweet, wins a Mike Collins lunch. There you go.
There we
go. All right. Last week, the big topic around the country was the separation of immigrant children from their parents. As both were captured as they were trying to enter the country illegally or without papers, et cetera, or not through channels, so let's put it that way. And that happened as a result of an executive order issued by the president. After the hue and cry, he issued a second executive order reversing the decision to separate parents and children. And I think at least one court has given the government 30 days to reunite younger children with their parents. But this week, North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein joined a group of attorneys general from around the country in suing the Trump administration over the second executive order, which repealed the first. So what's up?
And it's not clear how the federal court judge's order in California about the reunification within 30 days, how that would affect the lawsuit by the North Carolina Attorney General and 16 other states.
Attorney General Stein was actually in town yesterday. I spoke to him briefly, and when I asked him that question, he said he said he is dissatisfied, and the others are as well, with the step that the president took to undo some of this, that there's still a lack of clarity. There's still obviously a ton of questions about where the children are and reuniting them with the families. And so the goal of the attorneys general is to make this, I guess, impossible or as close to impossible in the future as possible.
This is 17 states. Are these all Democratic attorneys general, I should say?
That's a good question.
I think a good number.
Yeah. Most likely. But I don't know if every one of them is. I don't know if there are any Republican attorneys general. Okay. That's so hard to say.
So these 17 people say that the president violated constitutional due process rights of families as well as equal protection guarantees by solely targeting individuals who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border and not those entering using other means. I'm not sure what that would be. Can you come into the country illegally on an airplane? You have to go through customs.
Well, you could overstay your visa. You could come through Canada. There's other options.
Fraudulently.
So this in the same week that the president has advocated that these people be afforded no due process and merely sent back across the border. So what happens next?
Wait for courts to weigh in.
I say wait and watch.
I think we're going to have a lot of hurry up and wait with the court system because this is going to go back. It already has, and it's going to continue to go back and forth. And again, there are all these questions about even the steps that have been taken. There's still no real clear answers on, okay, where are all these children? Will they be reunited with their parents? And then there is the most high-profile part of this, I think, which is that you had the episode of toddlers in court. Which I heard reports this week that that's happened before. This is not unprecedented, but certainly it was thrown into sharp relief given the other events this week.
The other thing that people aren't talking about, there's a huge backlog of these cases, of these trials for people who enter the country without documentation. And the zero tolerance policy is still in place. So that list is growing. So one question is, you know, how are they going to work through that backlog? Where are they going to put these families? It just really points to the need for Congress and the president to get together and figure out how to solve this.
It's difficult to say because you're only getting reports that are fairly vague, and reporters are not allowed to take cameras into these places where they're storing these children in cages. It's hard to believe that the government would not have had some process in place to be able to rematch these children with their parents. Are we to assume that they really didn't? That there are some situations where they have no idea that this infant or this toddler who can barely tie their shoes and say their name would not know where his parents or her parents have been stored also?
It's tough. I think there's a lot of chaos at the border. And on top of that, you mentioned we're dealing with children who don't know their name. They don't know how to speak English. They barely know their phone number. So it is a lot of just chaos, and it's trying to clear up who belongs to who. And just, I think, as Glenn said, there really is no policy. And that, I think, needs to happen to clear up any kind of chaos down there at the border.
Mind-boggling.
And I don't think it's a surprise that this administration creates policy before, you know, creating procedure to go along with it.
Yeah, but that's why you have bureaucrats to say, wait a minute, let's put this Excel spreadsheet in place. I mean, no one said anything like that?
Well, that's worked with other administrations. That has not worked as well with this one.
Okay. We're also hearing about the trauma that this separation might cause these children, which has also added to the anger over this issue. Scott Phillips is the head of North Carolina's Office of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants.
One of the big issues to remember is that people don't leave home on a whim. You're fleeing for a reason. And a lot of times there's trauma on the journey.
So that's one thing to consider, I suppose. But still, why are these attorneys general getting involved in what is a federal case? And most of these states that are getting involved are not states at the border?
Well, I think one answer is that when you look at what's happened since Trump took office, you've seen this pattern, which is attorneys general trying to combat some of the administration's policies and essentially, I guess, trying to work around Congress because you have a Congress aligned with the president trying to take steps to push back on what the president and his administration are doing, and with mixed success.
Right. I mean, the travel ban lawsuits came from states, Hawaii and Washington. So I assume that there will be more. I think California's attorney general has sued on other issues as well.
So we have an answer from our Cracker Jack producers about the number of people who can be on the Supreme Court at any time. The original Constitution did not set the number of justices on the court. Therefore, it was up to Congress to decide. And in 1801, it set the number at five. The number of Supreme Court justices has changed over the years, according to Kathy Arbour, who's a spokesperson for the Supreme Court, and she said the number of justices has been as high as 10. The Judiciary Act of 1869 officially set the number at 9, and it has not budged since.
Remember, we were all on this panel. We had the Friday News Roundup, 1869.
That
was
That
was a good one.
It was a Friday, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was.
Might have been a little chillier. I can't remember.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's move on now to the White House.
I don't believe, and I don't even think it's close, that any president has done what we've done in 500 days.
Well, that's Donald Trump, but he's not at the White House making that speech. He's not talking about just what he's doing at the border, but he's all that he has accomplished as president. He made that statement in what has been described as a rambling hour-long speech in West Columbia on Monday, stumping for South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster in his primary runoff campaign. The president didn't spend a lot of time talking about Henry McMaster.
But he still won on Tuesday,
exactly.
So
it's a very thorough overview of the Nielsen rating system, however.
It turned into a rally victory lap for himself. He did, however, encourage people, and I quote, to get off your asses and vote. Very presidential. And on Tuesday, McMaster won. So people got off their asses and voted. Did Trump tip the scales, or would McMaster have won anyway?
I think McMaster was the party favorite in Columbia because he took over for Nikki Haley when she was moved over to the White House in 2016. So he had been in the governor role for a little bit, and he was a lieutenant governor before that. But he was also, McMaster was the first person to endorse Trump way back before South Carolina's primary. So he was, you know, supporting Trump before Trump was really a force to be reckoned with on the campaign trail.
And certainly in a state like South Carolina, I mean, I think it almost goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. If you are a Republican and you cling tightly to President Trump, you're probably going to benefit from that. And Henry McMaster certainly did.
I want to go back to that audio clip you played. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a month ago I would have disagreed with that, but Trump has had a really, really good month. Say what you will about the policies, but he's been on a tear lately. Supreme Court decisions, the meeting with South Korea, getting immigration to the fore, even if chaotically.
Travel ban upheld.
He's starting to have a significant impact on this country. He got off to a very slow start, but he's.
Is that because the people he had around him held him back, and he's gotten rid of all those people and has taken the reins himself?
I don't know. That's a good observation, though.
But I think if you look at what Glenn just said, or you listen to what Glenn just said, many of these things are outside of legislation. And clearly, he doesn't have any feel for legislation, really any knowledge of how legislation works. But he does have a very strong feel for those beliefs that you just outlined, things that the Supreme Court can back up and support him on. And so that is where he is making the most impact. And beyond the Supreme Court, look at all the conservative judges that he's been able to appoint in lower level courts. I think that's really where you're starting to see the impact of Donald Trump as president.
He may go down as one of the most significant presidents we've had. And I use that word significant. People will argue about his policies or whatever, But he is fundamentally reshaping this country in some very significant ways.
And the language as well, the way we speak, because he seems to have a preoccupation with body parts.
But he also knows how to mobilize people. We'll say that. Because, I mean, I was not in Columbia, but my colleague Jonathan Lowe was, and he said people waited out for hours in the blistering heat just to see the president. I mean, many of them had McMaster signs, but he said a lot of people wanted to see the president. So I think that says something when people mobilize to that degree to see one person.
So after he made this, what was described wasn't there either, but was described as a rambling hour-long speech, which is what his rally speeches are. He just goes off script and just talks about things off the top of his head, very effectively, I might add, because his constituency absolutely loves that when he does it. McMaster was there, too. Henry McMaster was actually at the rally.
He was at the rally. We can confirm that.
And he spoke as well, and he wasted no time in giving the president his due at that rally on Monday.
Donald Trump has kept every promise that he's made. We love him. We follow him. He's going to make America great again. We're going to help him do it. We're going to do it right here in South Carolina.
McMaster was one of the first statewide elected South Carolinians to endorse Donald Trump when he was the lieutenant governor of South Carolina. So now Trump owns the Republican Party. South Carolina is quite obviously Trump country. Would that be inaccurate to say?
That would not be inaccurate to say at all.
In fact, the person that he was challenging in the runoff was also trying to ally himself with more with Trump. It was who liked Trump more, who was more like Trump.
So, it was kind of like the 9th congressional race.
Yes.
No, exactly. So, I think you're seeing that nationally is how well can you align yourself with the president and will it work in your campaign?
So the president was repaying loyalty. Because he could have gone either way with the Republican candidate and gotten the praise fest.
I don't think I'm giving away a secret here that if you flatter Donald Trump, he tends to return the favor.
So the Democratic challenger, very quickly, is Representative James Smith of Columbia. Does he have a shot at this?
Dead in the water.
Not in South Carolina.
Okay. Not in South Carolina.
And with that, happy
But go
note,
vote, though.
Get off your ass.
You left out part. Yeah, there you go.
Go vote.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk about city council incentives for Amazon and more on the I-77 tolls, perhaps, if there is any more to talk about with that. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Alex Olgan is here from the WFAE newsroom. Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News Charlotte. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Amazon is not going to bring its second North American headquarters to Charlotte, but we are getting a distribution center.
We got our swagger back. Amazon's coming to Charlotte.
Hold off a moment on that swagger, city councilman.
That is the quote of the week.
Oh, that really was.
That's James Mitchell, city councilman. How much of the reason for Amazon's decision to bring a distribution center here has to do with the fact that they didn't give us HQ2 and they're feeling so badly about it, or the $13.4 million in incentives that city council voted to give them?
Well, let's just start with, I think that a $5 billion second headquarters versus a $200 million distribution center, there's a little bit of difference. we can swagger, but we might have to be a little bit humble in our swaggering.
Was he serious about that?
Oh no, that was full.
Was a joke?
No, he was dead serious. Yeah. We got our swagger back. I mean, that was, you heard swagger. We're back.
Yes. He also kept saying, "Dust off your resumes." I didn't know if that was a shot at the precarious nature of being in the media or just in general. So, I was going to say, but on the $13 million worth of incentives, certainly that helps. There could be more incentives once the jobs start arriving. But I will say, at the same time, no matter where Amazon goes, they're getting incentives. So, they're going to get theirs wherever they go.
And this is actually the fourth Amazon facility in the Charlotte area, is it not? I mean,
but, Mike, you order so much stuff. You personally order so much on Prime that they've got to upgrade their technology so they can get it faster to your door.
The only thing I order on Prime is TV. That's it. this was called, for the longest time, Project Quattro.
It was. It was very mysterious.
Yes. And just before the council voted on the incentives, Mayor Vi Lyles revealed, nothing up my sleeve, revealed this was for Amazon. Why the secrecy?
Well, for the longest time, on Project Quattro's page, there were, the city was dealing with a company called CF Hippolyta Charlotte. And what does Hippolyta mean? What does that mean in Greek mythology? The queen of the Amazons.
Well, everybody knows that.
Exactly.
Brent Cagle would not say the word Amazon.
Say a word. And we're like, you know, that means queen of the Amazons. Oh, really? So needless to say, Monday we were like, okay, guys, can we just, you know, we all kind of know it's Amazon. But James Mitchell, I think, was the first to publicly kind of announce it was Amazon before the meeting in the chambers. And he was obviously very excited about that.
Yes, let's hear from James Mitchell.
Go ahead.
One more time. It may take them a while to get it up because they're not ready back in Radio Central.
We got our swagger back. Is that
that was the one I wanted to play, but I guess they're
but
not
I mean,
listening.
It is worth noting. I mean, it is 1,500 jobs, which is a sizable amount for Charlotte. Those jobs are 25,000 to 45,000, and some people are like, it's kind of on the low end. But I mean, I think average wise, Kannapolis's distribution center is about 31,000 to or 31,000 as well. That's the average salary. So we're talking about, I think, again, it's jobs in an area that we need jobs. And I know Mitchell at least says the city has asked Amazon to do some recruitment in the West Side area where this distribution center will go. So that will be interesting if they really make an effort to get folks from that area.
And as we know, that's not all that James Mitchell says.
We got our swagger back. Amazon's coming to Charlotte.
There we go.
Had to hear it twice. Make it your phone, you know, ringer.
So were we in competition with other areas nearby, with other cities in the country for this, that we had to provide the $13.4 million in incentives? Or is that just pro forma? You must provide these incentives if you want us to locate wherever we locate.
Well, one of the things that Brent Cagle from the airport was saying was that these are mostly road and infrastructure improvements that are going to be needed anyway around the airport. Remember, I think this is about 90 acres, this project, and the airport has something like 2,000 acres that they're looking to develop with similar type projects. So that was part of the motivation. But to go back to your original question, I think it's inevitable when Amazon, that kind of high-profile company, is bringing in jobs that they're going to get incentives.
And it should be mentioned that Brent Cagle, who runs the airport, will be your guest on this program on Monday at 9, Eric. Charlotte City Council, and I think you just alluded to this, Kirsten, is also pushing to improve minority business participation in city projects and contracts. 2 weeks ago, they deferred the decision on a new police station in order to put the spotlight on efforts to increase minority business participation, and council was expected to vote on that project on Monday night, did they?
Not going to lie, 9 o'clock deadline, had to leave after they voted for Amazon. is the life of TV. Thank you, Eric.
It was unanimously approved. They did, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
See, that's how we work here, you know.
That's right, absolutely.
Paper and TV, we're all in coop
together. It takes
a
village. We're going to keep this thing together.
Everybody has a deadline.
But hey, we made deadline right at 9 o'clock. News station at 9.
Okay. City Council also heard a pitch from UNC Charlotte Chancellor Phil Dubois and the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority for a hotel and conference center at the J.W. Clay Boulevard UNC Charlotte stop on the Blue Line extension. It's an $84 million project that would break ground this summer and be completed by 2020. What would it entail?
Basically, they want to create this hotel conference room development literally right by the university. And the chancellor mentioned that there are a lot of academic conferences that we might be missing out on because academics, professors, they want to hang out by the university. They're not exactly trying to go to Uptown. They want to be by, you know, the school, the arts, all right there. So they're asking City Council for $8 million in the restricted tourism dollars.
For $8 million?
$8 million, yes. So the school, the university is actually taking on most of that cost, but they do want City Council to chip in $8 million, and they would have a stake in this and that they could have a set amount of rent-free days to use the facility. So it's an interesting concept, and it's something that Dubois said it happens at other universities where there is this conference center near the university. Right.
Well, we've been trying to expand the number of hotel rooms in the area. What did City Council decide, or have they decided on this yet?
They have not decided. This was more of a briefing saying, hey, this is what we want to do, and they will have a public hearing on the rezoning in July, and then City Council will take a vote on that rezoning in August. So that will be our first indication on whether they support this or not and willing to give that $8 million.
So we're halfway through 2018, and this is supposed to be open in 2020. That's, 18 months?
August 2020.
Okay.
To be exact.
So almost... 2 years.
Almost 2 years, yeah.
Can they do that in 2 years? Can they do it in 2 years? Can they build it?
They feel pretty confident.
Okay. Last week, we talked briefly about any reprieve that opponents for the I-77 toll lanes might have kind of died in committee in Raleigh, and the legislature will soon end their short session and go home. But we're still hearing news about this, and according to the Business Journal, that's your publication, Eric, late summer looks like the earliest date for the North Carolina Department of Transportation to make a recommendation on what to do about the contract with Cintra, which is the parent company of I-77 Mobility Partners, which will be operating these toll lanes in perpetuity. Evidently.
Is there 50 years.
Is there any real possibility that they'll recommend ending this? Or is this just another last straw pipe dream?
I think that the sentiment has shifted a bit toward recommending either canceling the contract where the state would run the toll lanes or altering it in some significant way. The basic problem remains, though, how do you pay for this? And that's what all these fights have boiled down to. You mentioned a couple of proposals. There was one in the Senate, one in the House. They both fell apart because of money. And so when you look at $300-$500 million to buy out this contract, somebody's going to lose. And that somebody's either going to be around Mecklenburg County or they're going to be in other parts of the state. And you can bet that lawmakers are not going to want to be the losers in that. So that's what I can't figure out is how they're going to pay for this. And then the second point I would make is, of course, there is this tug of war between the governor and his powers to settle this and the legislature saying, no, we control the purse strings here if there's going to be any change.
So last week, the North Carolina House decided it wants to put a referendum on the November ballot to amend the state constitution to require voter ID. They want the voters, imagine this, to vote on this. Yesterday, a Senate committee was scheduled to debate the change requiring voter ID at the polls. Were they also debating about whether or not to put this on the ballot as a referendum? And what, in fact, did they decide? Does anybody know?
I don't know what they decided, but based on the philosophical bent of the legislature, I think that the House Speaker and the Senate President are in alignment on this. Phil Berger has been a pretty strong proponent of voter ID, and so I would be surprised if this ended up anywhere but on the ballot in November.
We might have to go back to our civics class, but isn't a referendum required to amend the Constitution?
Yes.
I believe it
yes.
is. Yes.
Yes. And so that's why that's why it would go on the ballot.
We'd have to get 2/3 in the legislature, and then it goes on the on the ballot.
We've learned a lot today, see?
Educational and informative.
Meanwhile, hepatitis at Hardee's. Now, there's a headline you don't want to read, particularly if you're at Hardee's. Mecklenburg County health officials urged customers of the Hardee's at 2604 Little Rock Road, that's near the airport, to get a hepatitis A vaccination as soon as possible, and they mean this, as soon as possible, following what's described as a possible outbreak. Fill us in, Kirsten and Alex.
Yeah, so there was an employee who tested positive for hepatitis A, and
why did that come up? How did we discover that? Just because he was sick and he went for a test and they...
I think that is the case. He went for... And that's the county has not been detailed on how this all came to be, but it's more they found out about it. The person tested positive for hepatitis A and handled food. And that was the concern, is that with handling food, whether it was one day or 10 days, you don't know how many people could have been possibly exposed to the virus. And so that's why they said, okay, get your shot. And it was 10 days. So it was June 13th to the 23rd. And that was also during the same time, if you remember, during the American Airlines glitch. So a lot of people were in town hanging around the airport and possibly could have gone to that Hardee's.
And hepatitis A you get from contaminated food or water or not sanitizing your hands well, and it could be transferred that way. So it's very possible to get it from this way of transmission. And then the vaccine is, you got to get it within 14 days of the exposure. So, June 13th, it's cutting it close. People really needed to, if they were going to get it.
Yeah, the people who visited the restaurant early really need to move on this.
Exactly.
Well, technically, they should have gotten it on Wednesday. First day they offered vaccines, that was the day those who ate on the 13th should have gotten it. That was the 14th day.
And they know from sales receipts that about 4,000 people ate at that restaurant, or at least there were 4,000 sales at that restaurant between June 13th and June 23rd. Some of them are locals. Some of them might have hopped an airplane and gotten out of here. Some of them might have taken their car and gone to Atlanta on I-85. Mm-hmm. So how do people know? I know this was in some national publications. It was on network news. Mm-hmm. But how do people know if they were just passing through and they got off the highway to get a sandwich and that's what they chose,
They may not know.
Yeah, and that's why the health director, Gibby Harris, says they're using us, the media, to help get the word out. But apparently they also have their own regional and national health systems. It's kind of like an alert for things like this that kind of spreads the words to local health departments saying, hey, this happened in Mecklenburg County. If you ate between this time, please go get checked out. And also, yesterday, Harris said that the state is now allowing any county health department in North Carolina to offer free hepatitis A vaccine. So that expands the range a lot more.
So what are the symptoms of hepatitis A, and how quickly do they present themselves? And if the symptoms present themselves, what's your recourse? What's the prognosis?
So it's not a chronic virus. You are sick for a couple of weeks to a couple months in most cases, unless you have some other complicating factor, which could make it much worse. But if you're just a regular, normal, healthy person, you're not going to be sick for more than, they say, a few weeks to a couple months. You have things like fatigue, nausea, stomach pain. You can get jaundice. It's not a good thing to get.
Because it attacks your liver, right?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what hepatitis means.
Okay.
But it's not chronic like hepatitis C is. But yes, it's a liver disease, and you will not feel good.
Mm. Okay, well, I guess we'll keep our eye on what happens as a result of
that. And vaccine clinics are open throughout the weekend, so that is another thing. They want people to get vaccinated, and if they need to keep those efforts going, Director Harris says they'll evaluate that on Sunday.
Alex? And the health department says that more than 2,000 people have been vaccinated so far. So that's, you know, 50
it's half of the sales.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Let's get back to the Panthers for just a second. The hedge fund billionaire minority owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, David Tepper, bought the Panthers. We all know this. Now Sports Business Daily is reporting that he wants the team's sole owner, to be the team's sole owner. He paid Jerry Richardson, who owned 48% of the team, a record price. How much will sole ownership cost him? I mean, does he have to pay more, or was the $2.275 billion for the whole kit and caboodle?
That was for 100% because Jerry Richardson had the rights to sell the entire team.
So the minority owners have to sell?
Well, that's a little harder to figure out. They have an option, and David Tepper has an option. And one of the things we don't know is, was there another fee that kicked in if David Tepper said, you know what, I'm not accepting any of these minority investors? So however that shakes out, because we don't have the details of the contract, he is buying the team, and it looks like he's going to be the sole owner, which would follow a trend in the NFL, which is a cleaner transaction. You don't have to go back to anybody to make decisions or even ask for an opinion on decisions. You march forward, and as we've said almost 11 billion times, he's worth $11 billion, so he can easily write the check and be the sole owner.
Wow. So it's just easier for him to do whatever he wants to do with the team.
Yes.
He doesn't have to ask anybody else. But when Jerry Richardson only owned 48%, and we never heard a peep from the minority owners, at least in public.
That's true. He did have a very ironclad grip over the ownership group. But the reason those minority investors were important, Mike, is because this was an expansion team, and they were able to really gin up excitement in terms of getting people to buy tickets, to buy sponsorships, all those kinds of things. Now you have a much more established franchise, and I think that's the view David Tepper comes in with, is they're in good shape. I'll take it from here.
Very quickly, traffic was impeded because a roadway was seeded when a tractor trailer tipped and watermelons slipped, breaking apart, making art, and putting their stamp on the ramp at 485. That's all I got. The part Lydia
Isidore Gazelle.
Better than what I had.
What a waste, not even a taste. What happened?
So a truck overturned on 485 with a bunch of melons, and let's just say, man, it's the pits. I'm so sorry. That's it. I'll see myself out.
That's Kirsten Darris, Governor, reporter, Spectrum News. She'll be hosting this program on Tuesday as a guest host. I take a little vacation, and she'll be talking about becoming a U.S. citizen. Eric Spanberg here with Brent Cagle from the airport on Monday. And on Wednesday, we get fireworks in the city. Why? Because
we got our swagger back. Amazon's coming to Charlotte.
That's right. So, Glenn Birkins here from QCityMetro.com and Alex Olgan, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.